Every day they woke to an alarm set for an hour before sunset and spent the last light of day eating a spare breakfast and watching the garish alpenglow colors spread with the shadows over the rugged landscape. Then every night they drove, without ever being able to use the autopilot, navigating the broken terrain kilometer by kilometer. Nergal and Art took the graveyard shift together on most nights and continued their long conversations. Then, as the stars faded and dawn's pure violet light stained the eastern sky, they found places where the boulder car would be inconspicuous, in this latitude the work of a moment, almost just a matter of stopping, as Art said, and ate a leisurely supper, watching the sharp blast of sunrise and its sudden creation of great fields of shadow. A couple of hours later, after a planning session and occasional trips out, they would darken the windshield and sleep through the day. At the end of another long night's conversation about their respective childhoods, Nergal said, "I suppose it wasn't until Sabishi that I realized that zygote was..." "Unusual," Coyote said from his sleeping mat behind them. "Unique? Bizarre? Heroku-like?" Nergal wasn't surprised to discover that Coyote was awake. The old man slept poorly and often muttered a dreamy commentary to Nergal and Art's narrative, which they generally ignored, as he was mostly asleep. But now Nergal said, "Zygote reflects Heroku, I think. She's very inward." "Ha!" Coyote said. "She didn't used to be." "When was that?" Art pounced, swiveling in his chair to include Coyote in their little circle of talk. "Oh, back before the beginning," Coyote said. "In prehistoric times, back on Earth." "Is that when you met her?" Coyote grunted affirmatively. This was where he always stopped when he was talking to Nergal. But now with Art there, with just the three of them awake in all the world, in a little circle lit by the infrared imager, Coyote's thin, crooked face had a different expression than its usual mulish dismissal, and Art leaned over him and said firmly, "So just how did you get to Mars anyway?" "Oh, God," Coyote said, and rolled onto his side, propping his head up on one hand. "It's hard to remember something that long ago. It's almost like an epic poem I memorized once and can barely recite anymore." He glanced up at them, then closed his eyes as if recalling the opening lines. The two younger men stared down at him, waiting. "It was all due to Heroku, of course. She and I were friends. We met young when we were students at Cambridge. We were both cold in England, so we warmed each other. This was before she met Awa'o and long before she became the great mother goddess of the world. And back then we shared a lot of things. We were outsiders at Cambridge, and we were good at the work. And so we lived together for a couple of years there. Very much like what Nergal has been saying about Sabishi, even what he said about Jackie. Although Heroku..." He closed his eyes as if trying to see it in his mind. "You stayed together?" Art asked. "No. She went back to Japan, and I went with her for a while, but I had to go back to Tobago when my father died. So things changed. But she and I stayed in touch and met at scientific conferences, and when we met, we fought or promised to love each other forever. Or both. We didn't know what we wanted, or how we could get it if we admitted what we wanted. And then the selection of the first 100 began. But I was in jail in Trinidad for objecting to the flag of convenience laws. And even if I had been free, I wouldn't have had a chance of being selected anyway. I'm not even sure I wanted to go. But Heroku either remembered our promises or thought I'd be useful to her. I have never decided which. So she contacted me and told me that if I wanted, she would hide me in the farm on the Ares, and then in the colony on Mars. She has always been a bold thinker, I give her that."
"Didn't it strike you as a crazy plan?" Art asked, his eyes round.
"Yes, it did," Coyote laughed. "But all the good plans are crazy, aren't they? And at that time my prospects were dim, and if I hadn't gone for it, I would never have seen Heroku again."
He looked at Nergal, smiled crookedly.
"So I agreed to try it.
I was still in prison, but Hiroko had some unusual friends in Japan, and one night I found myself being led out of my cell by a trio of masked men and every guard in the jail sedated. We took a helicopter to a tanker ship, and I sailed on that to Japan. The Japanese were building the space station that the Russians and Americans were using for the construction of the Ares, and I was flown up in one of the new Earth-to-space planes and slipped into the Ares just as construction was ending. They popped me in with some of the farm equipment Hiroko had ordered, and after that it was up to me. I lived by my wits from that moment on, all the way to this very moment, which meant I was pretty hungry at times, until the Ares began its flight. After that, Hiroko took care of me. I slept in a storage compartment behind the pigs and stayed out of sight. It was easier than you might think because the Ares was big. And when Hiroko got confident in the farm crew, she introduced me to them, and it was easier yet. Where it got hard was on the ground in those first weeks after we landed. I went down in a lander filled with only the farm crew, and they helped me get settled in a closet in one of the trailers. Hiroko got the greenhouses built fast, mostly to get me out of that closet, or so she would tell me.
You lived in a closet?
For a couple of months. It was worse than jail. But after that, I lived in the greenhouse and started work on stockpiling the materials we needed to take off on our own. Iwao had hidden the contents of a couple of freight boxes right from the start, and after we'd built a rover out of spare parts, I spent most of my time away from Underhill exploring the chaotic terrain and finding a good place for our hidden shelter and moving stuff out there. I was out on the surface more than anyone, even Anne. By the time the farm team moved out there to it, I was used to spending a lot of time on my own. Just me and Big Man out wandering the planet. I tell you, it was like heaven. No, not heaven. It was Mars. Pure Mars. I guess I lost my mind in a way, but I loved it so I can't really talk about it.
You must have taken a lot of radiation. Coyote laughed.
Oh, yes. Between those journeys and the solar storm on the Ares, I took on more REMs than anyone in the first 100, except maybe for John. Maybe that's what did it. Anyway, he shrugged, looked up at Art and Nergal. Here I am, the stowaway.
Amazing, Art said. Nergal nodded. He had never gotten his father to reveal even a tenth as much information about his past, and now he looked from Art to Coyote and back again, wondering how Art had done it. And done it to him as well, for Nergal had tried to tell not only what had happened to him, but what it had meant, which was much more difficult. Apparently, this was a talent Art had, though it was very hard to pin down what it consisted of. Just the look on his face, somehow, that cross-eyed intensity of interest. Those bald, bold questions, trampling on the niceties and going straight to the heart of things, assuming that every person wanted to talk, to shape the meaning of their life. Even secretive, weird old hermits like Coyote.
Well, it wasn't that hard, Coyote was saying now. Concealment is never as hard as people think. You must understand that. It's action while hiding that's the hard part.
At that thought he frowned, then pointed a finger at Nergal.
This is why we will have to come out eventually and fight in the open. This is why I got you to go to Sabishi.
What?
You told me I shouldn't go. You said it would ruin me. That's how I got you to go.
They kept up this nocturnal, conversational life for the better part of a week, and at the end of it they approached a small, settled region surrounding the molehole that had been dug in the midst of craters Hipparchus, Eudoxus, Ptolemaeus, and Lifan. There were some uranium mines on the aprons of these craters, but Coyote didn't suggest any sabotage attempts, and they drove hard past the Ptolemaic molehole, getting away from the region as quickly as possible. Soon they came to the Thaumasia fossae, the fifth or sixth big fracture system they had encountered on their trip. Art found this curious, but Spencer explained to him that the Tharsis bulge was surrounded by fracture systems caused by its uplift, and as they were in effect circumnavigating the bulge, they kept running into them.
Thaumasia was one of the biggest of these systems and the location of the large town of Senzeni-Na, which had been founded next to another of the 40-degree latitude moholes, one of the first moholes to be dug and still one of the deepest. At this point they had been traveling for over 2 weeks, and they needed to restock at one of Coyote's caches. They drove south of Senzeni-Na, and near dawn were weaving between rocky ancient hillocks. But when they came to the bottom end of a landslide coming off a low broken scarp, Coyote started cursing. The ground was marked by rover tracks and a scattering of crushed gas cylinders, food boxes, and fuel containers. They stared at the sight. "Your cache?" Art asked, which provoked another outburst of swearing. "Who were they?" Art asked. "Police?" No one answered immediately. Sax went to one of the driver's seats to check supply gauges. Coyote continued cursing furiously, plopping meanwhile into the other driver's seat. Finally, he said to Art, "It wasn't police, not unless they've started using Vishniak rovers. No, these thieves were from the underground, damn them. Probably an outfit I know based in Argyre. I can't think of anyone else who would do it. But this crowd knows where some of my old caches were, and they've been mad at me ever since I sabotaged a mining settlement in the Caridims because it closed down after that and they lost their main source of supplies." "You folks should try to stay on the same side," Art said. "Fuck off," Coyote advised him. Coyote started up the boulder car and drove away. "It's the same old story," he said bitterly. "The resistance begins fighting itself because that's the only thing it can beat. Happens every time. You can't get any movement larger than 5 people without including at least one fucking idiot." He went on in that vein for quite some time. Finally, Sax tapped at one of the gauges, and Coyote said roughly, "I know!" It was full daylight, and he stopped the car in a cleft between two of the ancient hillocks, and they blacked the windows and lay in the dark on their narrow mattresses. "So how many underground groups are there?" Art asked. "No one knows," Coyote said. "You're kidding." Nergal answered before Coyote started in again. "There's about 40 in the southern hemisphere, and some long-standing disagreements among them are getting nasty. There are some tough groups out there. Radical Reds, Schnelling, splinter groups, different kinds of fundamentalists. It's causing trouble." "But aren't you all working for the same thing?" "I don't know." Nergal recalled all-night arguments in Sabishi, sometimes quite violent, among students who were basically friends. "Maybe not."
"But haven't you talked it over?"
"Not in any formal way, no."
Art looked surprised. "You should do that," he said.
"Do what?" Nergal asked.
"You should convene some kind of meeting of all the underground groups and see if you can't agree about what you're all trying to do, how to settle disputes and like that."
Aside from a skeptical snort from Coyote, there was no response to this. After a long time, Nergal said, "My impression is that some of these groups are wary of Gamete because of the first 100 in it. No one wants to give up any autonomy to what's already perceived as the most powerful sanctuary."
"But they could work on that at a meeting," Art said. "That's part of what it would be for, among other things. You all need to work together, especially if the Transnat police get more active after what they found out from Sax." Sax nodded at this. The rest of them considered it in silence.
Somewhere in the consideration, Art started to snore, but Nergal was awake for hours thinking about it. They approached Senzeni-Na in some need. Their food supplies were adequate if they rationed them, and the car's water and gases were recycling so efficiently that there was little loss there. But they were simply short of fuel to run the car.
"We need around 50 kilos of hydrogen peroxide," Coyote said.
He drove up to the rim of Thaumasia's biggest canyon, and there in the far wall was Senzeni-Na behind great sheets of glass, the arcades all full of tall trees. The canyon floor in front of it was covered with walk tubes, small tents, the great factory apparatus of the mohole itself, which was a giant black hole at the south end of the complex, and the tailings mound, which ran up the canyon far to the north. This was reputed to be the deepest mohole on Mars, so deep that the rock was getting a bit plastic at the bottom, squishing in, as Coyote put it, 18 kilometers deep, with the lithosphere in the area about 25. The mohole operation was almost completely automated, and the majority of the town's population never went near it. And many of the robot trucks hauling rock out of the hole used hydrogen peroxide for fuel, so the warehouses down on the canyon floor next to the mohole would have what they needed. And security down there dated from before the unrest and had been designed in part by John Boone himself, so it was woefully inadequate to withstand Coyote's methods, particularly since he had all of John's old programs in his AI. The canyon was exceptionally long, however, and Coyote's best way down to the canyon floor from the rim was a climbing trail some 10 kilometers down canyon from the mohole.
That's fine, Nergal said. I'll get it on foot.
50 kilos?
Coyote said.
I'll go with him, said Art. I may not be able to do mystic levitation, but I can run.
Coyote thought it over, nodded.
I'll lead you down the cliff.
So he did that, and in the time slip, Nergal and Art took off with empty backpacks draped over their air tanks, running along easily over the smooth canyon floor north to Senzeni Na. It seemed to Nergal that it was going to be a simple operation. They came up on the mohole complex without a problem, the starlight now augmented by the diffuse light of the town shining out of the glass and reflecting off the far wall. Coyote's program got them through a garage lock and into the warehouse area as quickly as if they had every right to be there, with no sign that they had tripped any alarms. But then, when they were in the warehouse itself, stuffing small hydrogen peroxide containers in their backpacks, all the lights in the place went on at once, and emergency doors slid shut. Art ran immediately to the wall away from the door and set a charge and moved aside. The charge exploded with a loud bang, blowing a sizable hole in the thin warehouse wall, and then the two of them were outside and skulking between gigantic drag lines to the perimeter wall. Suited figures came racing out of the walk-tube lock from the town, and the two intruders had to dive behind one of the drag lines, a structure so big that they could stand in the crack between individual tractor treads. Nergal felt his heart pounding against the metal. The suited figures went into the warehouse, and Art ran out and set another charge. The flash of light from this one blinded Nergal, and he ducked through the gap in the fence and ran for it without seeing a thing, without feeling the 30 kilograms of fuel packets bouncing on his back and crushing the air tanks into his spine. Art was ahead of him again, badly out of control in the Martian G, but nonetheless bounding along with those great surging strides. Nergal almost laughed as he worked to catch up with him, hitting his rhythm, and then, as he drew abreast of him, trying to show him by example how to use his arms properly, in a sort of swimming motion, rather than the rapid pumping that was throwing Art off balance so often. Despite the dark and their speed, it seemed to Nergal that Art's arms began to slow down. And they ran. Nergal took the lead and tried to pick the cleanest route over the canyon floor, the one least littered with rocks. The starlight seemed more than sufficient to illuminate their way. Art kept pounding up to his right, pressing him to hurry. It almost became a kind of race, and Nergal ran much faster than he would have on his own or in any normal circumstances. So much of it was rhythm and breath, and the dispersal of heat from the torso out into the skin and then the walker. It was surprising to see how well Art could keep up with him, without the advantage of any of the disciplines. He was a powerful animal. They almost ran right by Coyote, who leaped out from behind a rock and scared them enough to knock them down like ninepins. Then they clambered up the rocky trail he had marked on the cliff wall, and were on the rim under the full dome of the stars again, the bright lights of Senzeni Na like a spaceship that had dived into the opposite cliff. Back in the boulder car, Art gasped for air, still out of breath from the run down the canyon.
"You're going to have to teach me that lungam," he said to Nergal. "My lord, you run fast."
"Well, you do, too. I don't know how you do it."
"Fear."
He shook his head, sucked at the air.
"This kind of thing is dangerous," he complained to Coyote.
"It wasn't my idea," Coyote snapped. "If those bastards hadn't stolen my supplies, we wouldn't have had to do it." Yeah, but you do stuff kinda like this all the time, right? And it's dangerous. I mean, you need to be doing something other than sabotage in the Outback. Something systemic. It turned out that 50 kilos was the absolute minimum they needed to get home, so they limped south with all non-critical systems shut off so that the interior of the car was dark and fairly cold. It was cold outside as well. Through the lengthening nights of the early southern winter, they began to encounter frost on the ground and snowdrifts. Salt crystals on top of the drifts served as the seed points for ice flakes, which grew into thickets of ice flowers. They navigated between these white crystalline fields, dimly glowing in the starlight, until the fields merged into one great white blanket of snow, frost, rime, and ice flowers. Slowly they drove over it, until one night the hydrogen peroxide ran out.
"We could have got more," Art said.
"Shut up," Coyote replied. They ran on battery power, which wouldn't last long. In the dark of the unlit car, the light cast by the white world outside was ghostly. None of them talked except to discuss the essentials of driving. Coyote was confident that the distance the batteries would take them would be enough to see them home, but they were cutting it awfully fine, and if anything failed, if one of the ice-clogged wheels jammed in its well, they would have to try walking, Nergal thought. Running. But Spencer and Sax wouldn't be able to run far. On the sixth night after the raid on Senzeni Na, however, around the end of the time slip, the frosty ground ahead became a pure white line which thickened on the horizon and then came clear of it, the white cliffs of the southern polar ice cap.
"It looks like a wedding cake," Art said, grinning.
They were almost out of battery power to the point that the car was slowing down, but Gamete was just a few kilometers clockwise around the polar cap, and so just after dawn, Coyote guided the halting car into the outlying garage in Nadia's crater rim complex. They walked the last stretch, crunching over new frost in the raw, long-shadowed morning light under the great white overhang of dry ice. Gamete gave Nergal the same feeling it always did, that he was trying to fit into old clothes that were much too small. But this time, Art was there with him, and so the visit had the interest of showing a new friend an old home. Every day Nergal took him around, explaining features of the place and introducing him to people. As he watched the range of expressions plainly exposed on Art's face, from surprise to amazement to disbelief, the whole enterprise of Gamete began to strike Nergal as truly odd. The white ice dome, its winds, mists, birds, the lake, the village, always freezing, weirdly shadowless, its white and blue buildings dominated by the crescent of bamboo treehouses, it was a strange place. And Art found all of the Issei equally amazing. He shook their hands, saying, "I've seen you on the vids. Very pleased to meet you." After introductions to Vlad and Ursula, Marina and Iwao, he muttered to Nergal, "It's like a wax museum." Nergal took him down to meet Hiroko, and she was her usual benign, distant self, treating Art with about the same reserved friendliness she gave to Nergal. Mother goddess of the world. They were in her labs, and feeling obscurely annoyed by her, Nergal took Art by the ectogene tanks and explained what they were. Art's eyes went perfectly round when he was surprised, and now they were like big white and blue marbles. "They look like refrigerators," he said, and stared closely at Nergal. "Was it lonesome?" Nergal shrugged, looked down at the small clear windows like portholes. Once he had floated in there, dreaming and kicking. It was hard to imagine the past, hard to believe in it. For billions of years he hadn't existed, and then one day, inside this little black box, a sudden appearance, green in the white, white in the green. "It's so cold here," Art remarked when they went back outside. He was wearing a big borrowed fiber-fill coat with the hood over his head. We have to keep a water ice layer coating the dry ice so the air stays good. So it's always a little under freezing, but not much. I like it myself. It strikes me as the best temperature of all.
Childhood.
Yeah. They visited Saxe every day, and he would croak, "Hello," or "Goodbye," in greeting, and try his best to talk. Michelle was spending several hours a day working with him. "It's definitely aphasia," he told them. "Vlad and Ursula did a scan, and the damage is in the left anterior speech center. Non-fluent aphasia, sometimes called Broca's aphasia. He has trouble finding the word, and sometimes he thinks he's got it, but what comes out will be synonyms or antonyms or taboo words. You should hear the way he can say, 'Bad results.' It's frustrating for him, but improvement from this particular injury is often good. Slow, however. Essentially, other parts of the brain have to learn to take over the functions of the damaged part, so we work on it. It's nice when it goes well, and it could be worse, obviously." Saxe, who had been staring at them through this, nodded quizzically. He said, "I want to teach. To speech." Of all the people in Gami to whom Nergal introduced Art, the one Art hit it off with best was Nadia. They were drawn to each other instantly, to Nergal's surprise. But it pleased him to see it, and he watched his old teacher fondly as she made her own kind of confession in response to Art's question barrage, her face looking very ancient except for her startling light brown eyes with the green flecks around the pupil. Eyes that radiated friendly interest and intelligence and amusement at Art's interrogation. The three of them ended up spending hours together in Nergal's room talking, looking down at the village or out the other window to the lake. Art walked around the little cylinder from window to door to window, fingering the cuts in the glossy green wood. "Do you call it wood?" he asked, looking at the bamboo. Nadia laughed. "I call it wood," she said. "It's Hiroko's idea to live in these things, and a good one. Good insulation, incredible strength, and no carpentry but door and window installation."
"I guess you wish you had these bamboo in Underhill, eh?"
"The spaces we had were too small, maybe in the arcades. Anyway, this species wasn't developed until recently."
She turned the interrogation on him and asked him scores of questions about Earth. What did they use for housing materials now? Were they going to use fusion power commercially? Was the UN irrevocably damaged by the War of 61? Were they trying to build a space elevator for Earth? How much of the population had gotten the aging treatments? Which of the big transnationals were the most powerful? Were they fighting among themselves for preeminence? Art answered these questions as fully as he could, and though he shook his head at the inadequacy of his answers, Nergal, for one, learned a lot from them, and Nadia seemed to feel the same. And they both found themselves laughing fairly often. When Art asked Nadia questions in turn, her answers were friendly but varied greatly in length. Talking about her current projects, she went on in detail, happy to describe the scores of construction sites she was working on in the Southern Hemisphere. But when he asked her questions about the early years in Underhill, in that bold, direct way of his, she usually just shrugged, even if he asked about building details. "I don't really remember it very well," she would say. "Oh, come on." "No, I'm telling the truth. It's a problem, actually. How old are you?"
50. Or 51, I guess. I've lost track of the date."
"Well, I am 120. Don't look so shocked. With the treatments, it's not so old. You'll see. I just had the treatment again 2 years ago, and I'm not exactly like a teenager, but I feel pretty good. Very good, in fact. But I think memory may be the weak link. It may be the brain just won't hold that much, or maybe I just don't try. But I'm not the only one having the problem. Maya is even worse than me. And everyone my age complains about it. Vlad and Ursula are getting concerned. I'm surprised they didn't think of this back when they developed the treatments."
"Maybe they did and then forgot."
Her laugh seemed to take her by surprise. Later at dinner, after talking about her construction projects again, Art said to her, "You really ought to try to convene a meeting of all these underground groups." Maya was at their table, and she looked at Art as suspiciously as she had in Ekkas Kazma.
"It isn't possible," she declared.
She looked much better than she had when they had parted, Nergal thought, rested, tall, rangy, graceful, glamorous. She seemed to have shrugged off the guilt of murder as if it were a coat she didn't like.
"Why not?" Art asked her. "You'd be a lot better off if you could live on the surface."
"This is obvious. And we could move into the demimonde if it were just that simple. But there is a large police force on the surface and in orbit, and the last time they saw us they were trying to kill us as quickly as possible, and the way they treated Sax does not give me any confidence that things have changed."
"I'm not saying they have, but I think there are things you could do to oppose them more effectively. Getting together, for instance, and making a plan, making contact with surface organizations that would help you, that kind of thing."
"We have such contacts," Maya said coldly.
But Nadia was nodding, and Nergal's mind was racing with images of his years in Sabishii, a meeting of the underground.
"The Sabishians would come for sure," he said. "They're already doing stuff like this all the time. That's what the demimonde is, in effect."
Art said, "You should think about contacting Praxis as well. My ex-boss, William Fort, would be very interested in such a meeting, and the whole membership of Praxis is involved in innovations you would like."
"Your ex-boss?" Maya said.
"Sure," Art said with an easy smile. "I'm my own boss now."
"You could say you are our prisoner," Maya pointed out sharply.
"When you're the prisoner of anarchists, it's the same thing, right?"
Nadia and Nergal laughed, but Maya scowled and turned away. Nadia said, "I think a meeting would be a good idea. We've let Coyote run the network for too long."
"I heard that,"
Coyote called from the next table. "Don't you like the idea?" Nadia asked him. Coyote shrugged.
"We have to do something, no doubt of that. They know we're down here now."
This caused a thoughtful silence. "I'm going north next week," Nadia said to Art. "You can come with me if you like. Nergal, you too if you want. I'm going to drop in on a lot of sanctuaries and we can talk to them about a meeting."
"Sure," Art said, looking pleased. And Nergal's mind was still racing as he thought of the possibilities.
Being in Gamete again brought dormant parts of his mind back alive, and he saw clearly the two worlds in one, the white and the green, split into different dimensions, folded through each other, like the underground and the surface world, joined clumsily in the demimonde. A world out of focus. So the next week, Art and Nergal joined Nadia and drove north. Because of Sax's arrest, Nadia didn't want to risk staying in any one of the open towns along their way, and she didn't even seem to trust the other hidden sanctuaries. She was one of the most conservative of the old ones in terms of secrecy. Over the years of hiding, she, like Coyote, had built a whole system of small shelters of her own, and now they drove from one to the next, spending the short days sleeping and waiting in relative comfort. They couldn't drive during the winter days because the fog hood had been lessening in thickness and area for several years now, and this year was often no more than a light mist or patchy low clouds swirling over the rough, lumpy land. Once they were descending a rough drop in a foggy morning after a 10 a.m. dawn, and Nadia was explaining that Anne had identified it as the remnant of an earlier Kazma Austral. "She says there are literally scores of fossil Kazma Australs down here, cut at different angles during earlier points in the cycle of precession." And the fog swept away, and they could suddenly see for many kilometers, all the way to the shaggy ice walls at the mouth of the present Kazma Austral, gleaming in the distance. They were exposed. Then the clouds closed over them again, very swiftly, enveloping them in murky, flowing white, as if they were traveling in a snowstorm in which the snowflakes were so fine that they defied gravity and blew about in suspension forever. Nadia hated that kind of exposure, no matter how brief, and so she continued to hide through the days. They looked out the little windows of her shelters onto swirling clouds, which sometimes caught the light in sparkling arrays, so bright it hurt to look at them. Sunbeams cut through gaps between clouds, striking the long ridges and scarps of the blindingly white land. Once they even experienced a full whiteout when all shadows disappeared and everything else. A pure white world in which it was impossible to make out even the horizon. On other days, ice bows threw curves of pale pastel color against the intense whites, and once, when the sun broke through, low over the land, it was surrounded by a ring of light as bright as it was. The landscape blazed white under this display, not uniformly, but in patches, all shifting rapidly in the ceaseless winds. Art laughed to see it, and he never stopped exclaiming over the ice flowers, now as large as shrubs, and studded with spikes and lacy fans, and growing into each other at their edges, so that in many areas the ground itself completely disappeared, and they drove across a crackling surface of shard blooms, crushing hundreds of them under their wheels. The long, dark nights were almost a comfort after days like that. Days passed, one like the next. Nergal found it very comfortable to travel with Art and Nadia. They were both even-tempered, calm, funny. Art was 51 and Nadia 120, and Nergal only 12, which was around 25 Terran years. But despite the discrepancies in age, they interacted as equals. Nergal could test his ideas on them freely, and they never laughed or scoffed, even when they saw problems and pointed them out. And in fact, their ideas meshed fairly well, for the most part. They were, in Martian political terms, moderate green assimilationists. Boonians, Nadia called it. And they had similar temperaments, which was something that Nergal had never felt before about anyone, not for the rest of his family in Gamet or his friends in Sabishi. As they talked, night after night, they dropped in briefly on some of the big sanctuaries of the South, introducing Art to the people there and broaching the idea of a meeting or congress. They took him to Bogdanov Vishniak and amazed him with the giant complex built deep into the Mohol, so much bigger than any other sanctuary. Art's pop-eyed face was as eloquent as a speech, and brought back to Nergal most acutely the feeling he had had as a child when he first visited it with Coyote. The Bogdanovists were clearly interested in a meeting, but Mikhail Yangel, one of the only one of Arkady's associates to survive 61, asked Art what the long-range purpose of such a meeting would be. To retake the surface. I see. Mikhail's eyes were wide. Well, I'm sure you would have our support for that. People have been afraid to even bring that subject up.
Very good. Nadia told Art as they drove on north. If the Bogdanovists support a meeting, then it will probably happen. Most of the hidden sanctuaries are either Bogdanovist or else heavily influenced by them.
From Vishniak, they visited the sanctuaries around Holmes Crater, known as the industrial heartland of the underground. These colonies were also mostly Bogdanovist, with any number of small social variations among them, influenced by early Martian social philosophers such as the prisoner Schelling, or Hiroko, or Marina, or John Boone. The Francophone utopians in Prometheus, on the other hand, had structured their settlement on ideas taken from sources ranging from Rousseau and Fourier to Foucault and Namy, subtleties Nergal hadn't been aware of when he had first visited. Currently, they were being strongly influenced by the Polynesians who had recently arrived on Mars, and their big warm chambers sported palm trees and shallow pools, so that Art said it seemed more like Tahiti than Paris.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 10 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 11.